League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
I was ejected from the White House, fired unceremoniously. I'm getting destroyed. I deserve to be fired. I made a mistake. I should have technically said that it was off the record. I did not say that. He treated it like it was on the record. He wasn't a gentleman about it. He had the right to do that. I got fired. I moved on. First of all, my wife has filed for divorce on me. Super pissed at me. I got to go patch it up with her. Thankfully, we did that. We're still married today. Thank God. Happier than ever. Thank God. Knock on wood. But I got to patch it up with her. I've got five children. I've got to make sure that they're okay. I'm taking a tremendous amount of heat in the press. I can deal with it. But remember, civilians don't like it. They don't like dealing with it, okay? They get upset about it. Somebody says something mean and nasty about me, one of my kids gets really upset. I don't get upset. It's part of the game. If you're in the NFL and you're wearing a helmet, you're going to get a concussion. If you go into politics, you're going to have somebody shit on you. It's just the way it works. Like, you can't get upset about it. You got to roll with it. It's part of the game. You know, so yeah, I'm dealing with all that horse shit. I'm getting lit up by late night comedians. I'm getting lit up by Saturday Night Live. I'm getting lit up by cable news pundits. I'm getting excoriated in the press by different journalists and so on and so forth. Big deal. If you grow up the way I did, you get over shit very quickly. Okay, so yeah, I'm catching up on sleep. I'm laughing about the shit. I don't care. You know, so Colbert asked me if I thought it was going to last a long time in a White House. I said, longer than a carton of milk in the refrigerator. I didn't think it was going to go like that. But it happened like that. I own my shit. I'm not going to pretend it didn't happen. I'm not going to pretend I didn't make mistakes. I think the beauty of a good, long, healthy life is owning your shit. Also, I got five kids. I don't want my kids. Look, I could tell you a bullshit story. I went to Tufts, Harvard Law School, built two very successful businesses, was on the Worth Magazine Top 85 Most Influential in Global Finance, go to the World Economic Forum in Davos, and I could paint this very rosy picture of myself, but then you won't see all the jagged lines of that ascent. And I think that's nonsense, and I think that hurts your kids. I'd rather have my kids see the full enchilada of the whole thing, because once people see that, they get comfortable with it. I want my kids to not be in my shadow, but to recognize it's okay to fail upwards and get your ass in gear and take risks. I left the White House in July of 2017. The sale got rejected by CFIUS in April of 2018. So it took about 9 months for CFIUS to tell us they were not going to approve that transaction. What do you think happens? All of that goes by the wayside, and I go back to work. I returned to SkyBridge. We are going to have a growth plan at SkyBridge, a little higher profile as a result of what happened, but I go back to work. In June of 2017, after I had met with Federal Reserve officials who are exploring the idea of digitizing the U.S. dollar, I know that SkyBridge needs to be in the digital asset space. I decided I got to pivot this firm. We're going to adapt and pivot into digital assets. I dusted myself off and bought the URL skybridgebitcoin.com. I told my staff that we need to get up to speed on the blockchain. And so we spent a year and a half researching the blockchain. If you're researching a new asset class, of course, you're going to read everything there is about it. You're going to find some of the industry leaders, the early adopters. You're going to go interview them or ask them to be interviewed. You're going to look at the custodians. Go to them and potentially see what their service module is that they're offering to be a potential client of theirs. You're going to talk to your friends in the banking industry and the research industry. You're going to talk to your friends in the government. You're going to say, well, what do you think of this? And do you think it's going to work? Or why don't you like it? And then you're going to gather your research, and then you're going to do what good tech technology analysts do, or because we're institutional money managers, we don't make the decision to move into digital assets until October, November of 2020. So I returned to SkyBridge. Let's call that September 1st, 2017. It takes us 3 years to make our first digital asset investment. Why? We're doing research. I want to see the thing scale more. I want it to get to 100 million wallets. You study the network effect. If Facebook starts out with one user, and it now has 3 billion users, it goes from one user to 2 users to 10 users to 20 users, and boom, you're at 3 billion users. Well, let's talk about Bitcoin. That's how Bitcoin started. Bitcoin's got over 340 million wallets today. But when I made my first Bitcoin investment, it had about 85 million wallets. Question to me was, can this get to 100 million wallets? At 100 million wallets, Bitcoin has value just in the network itself. Remember what Robert Metcalf, the professor from MIT, said? He said that one fax machine has no value, but 200 million fax machines, that's an information superhighway that has value. The value is in the network itself. And so Bitcoin has that. And so you can actually intrinsically value Bitcoin off of its technical properties, off of the technology, the users, the immutability. I don't think people fully appreciate this that are in traditional finance, but if I tell you Bitcoin's premise, its idea is that I can trade something to you without permission, there's a whole world of value in that. I've got to get comfortable with the regulation, or at least the prognosis of the regulation. I want to store it in a safe place. Decentralized exchanges are not safe. Now Gox has gone bankrupt in 2014. Binance is an international enterprise. I don't know the people there, but I can store it at Fidelity. I have a long-standing relationship with them. I know them well. It's going to be in cold storage at Fidelity. I have no problem with that. I can store it there. So I get comfortable, and then we start making a nine-figure investment in Bitcoin. I like making money, and I like making money for my clients. And the truth be told, as an institutional investor, this was a very high-risk proposition to go into digital assets. So when I went into digital assets, Bitcoin was at 16, 17,000. It shot up to 69,000. I was told that I was a hero, and institutional clients were calling me saying, thank you so much for bringing me into the future. And then it went from 69,000 to 16,000. And those very same institutional clients called me and said, you're a dunce and you're an idiot. I would like to redeem all my money. And so, you know, there's a reason why institutional investors don't go into Bitcoin. It's very highly volatile. It's early stage. It's a speculative asset right now. Why? Well, it's emerging. It's adopting. Let me take you to 1903, for example. The Wright brothers are flying a biplane on Kitty Hawk, North Carolina, and they've discovered flight aviation. It's 14 years later. It's now 1917, and there are skeptics saying there will be no commercial viability for aviation, none whatsoever. Okay, so you go from 1903, 14 years later, to 1917, no commercial viability for airlines. And so those skeptics missed all the commercial viability for the aviation industry. My point is we're still very, very early. I cannot predict the future, but I can observe the past. So let's observe the past together. 25 short years ago was 1998. I was logging on to a fat boxed computer with a corded mouse, and underneath my desk was a whirring and burring modem. You could dial it up, you could hear it, catch a dial tone, and then it would burr and whir into the internet. And then 35 seconds later, perhaps 50 seconds later, my landing page for AOL arrives. It says I have mail. I can use my email account. I can buy a Pez gun from eBay. I can buy a book from Amazon. Okay, but that's the internet. Very clunky, more or less ineffective. But let's say I fast forward, or let's say I'm a time traveler coming from 2023. And I say, hey, Anthony, by the way, what you're doing right now, in 25 years, you're going to have a smart computer. I'm not going to call it a smartphone, but it's going to be a supercomputer in your hand. There's be laptops and tablets, and there'll be something called Wi-Fi, and it'll be broadbanded so you can download 4K video. In fact, there'll be billions of people downloading 4K video, including shows like White Lotus, amazing show, by the way. And there'll be trillions of dollars of transactions happening on this thing known as the internet. So my point is, there was no way anybody in 1998 could see all the use cases and see all of the exponential development on the internet. And I think it's the same thing with the blockchain right now. We're looking at the blockchain, it's fairly clunky. The use cases are small, the applications are small. It's the 1917 commercial aviation business, or it's the 1998 internet. In 10, 15, or 20 years from now, it's going to be exponentially different and way more robust. And I don't want my clients to miss that. I want them to be able to look to the future, ride through the volatility, and be a part of this thing, which I think is going to change the world.
My name is David Z. Morris for CoinDesk. I think that there are some crossovers between the way, and this is not how it's supposed to be, but especially for the last 10 years, there has been more crossover between the ways that supposed professional investors act and the way that individual retail investors can act. And I think that probably the single best way to describe it is, you know, we have this term in crypto, FOMO, fear of missing out. So things can move very fast in crypto, and not just the markets, but deals and things like that. And so a lot of investors really just want to get on that cap table by any means necessary. And they, you know, have gotten to a point where asking questions can actually get you denied access to a round, which again, the system is diseased at that point. But that's the dynamic, is if I don't buy this stake now, maybe it's going to be worth $1 billion later, and then I'll look really bad to my LPs. I don't think I had heard of SBF until early 2021, or maybe late 2020. I can't remember the exact timeline, but I had worked at Fortune for a couple of years as a staff reporter there. It's a bit of a funny story, actually, that I think illustrates his position in the marketplace. I was actually running the crypto newsletter at Fortune, and there had begun to be some talk about SBF. He founded Alameda in 2017, and I think that maybe like 2019 he started to become a figure people were talking about, but I wasn't paying attention. I'm not particularly interested in exchanges. And so when I got to CoinDesk and started focusing more specifically on crypto in, early 2021, I had to ask somebody. You know, everybody's talking about this SBF guy. Who is SBF? So he was very much a latecomer to crypto. And at various times and in various ways, he has pretty much explicitly said that he was never interested in crypto as a technology. He was primarily, he came out of a background at Jane Street where he was an active trader. And so he just saw it as basically a financial instrument that he could make money on, primarily trading at Alameda. He really only started FTX. It's now even more clear than it was before that he really only started FTX to get liquidity, or as it turned out, just straight up steal money for Alameda to play with.
I make my first Bitcoin investments October, November, December of 2020. I don't meet SBF until June of 2021. I think he comes on the radar March, April. There's an announcement that a cryptocurrency exchange is buying the naming rights for what was formerly known as the American Airlines Arena in Miami. They're going to change the name to the FTX Arena. American Airlines is pulling out of the naming rights deal. It's a $175 million deal over 20 or so years, and people are like, whoa, that's a big number. Who the hell is FTX? And then coincidentally, one of my buddies calls me and says, listen, there's a young man, he's a cryptocurrency billionaire, he's made a fortune in Bitcoin and other cryptocurrencies. He would like to meet you. We're going to set up a Zoom between you and him, and he wants to talk to you about the notion of sponsoring your conference.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loan subject to approval in available locations.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
What gets people's attention during these bull markets and hype cycles, it's just money. It's just like, I can say I'm a billionaire and therefore people are going to pay attention to me. And I mean, I will say, according to what I've heard from traders, FTX was genuinely a top tier exchange in terms of the experience and the front end and the tools. So I think he did legitimately get a lot of attention because of what he had built. But I think that probably the majority of it came from this idea that he was a genius trader and he had made a bunch of money, which turns out to pretty much not have been true. And then second, his self-promotion. I mean, he was very proactive in getting out the message, whether it was his actual wealth or the success of Alameda, or as you know, we found out to be kind of more nefarious, his rhetoric about effective altruism and what he was going to do with all of this money that he was supposedly making.
We have a wonderful conference business here called SALT. SALT is a thought leadership conference. You can go to salt.org and see the list of speakers that we've had. We've had presidents, including President Biden, Clinton, and Bush. We've had secretaries of state, including Condoleezza Rice, Colin Powell. Secretaries of defense, including Leon Panetta and Robert Gates. Prime ministers like Cameron and Gordon Brown and Tony Blair. We had a very eclectic mix of hedge fund managers, policy wonks, economists, and a ton of family offices and capital allocators actually come to these conferences to meet hedge funds and think of new investment ideas. And so we do that all over the world. We did it 10 times in Las Vegas, twice in New York, once in Tokyo, three times in Singapore. We did it in Abu Dhabi. It's been great fun for me to put on. It's great networking for our firm, but it's also a lucrative business. 2021 is still a year of COVID. We're going through different variants, Delta variant, Omicron, different variants of COVID. And so we cancel our SALT conference in May of 2020. We cancel our SALT conference in May of 2021. We're going to try to have the SALT conference in September because it seems like it's going to be safer to do that. People are vaccinating, et cetera. And so here we are in June of 2021. Sam Bankman-Fried is coming in with his afro and his ear, pod, you know, sort of earmuffs on. Hello, Anthony. And he's got that like nasally voice. And I'm like, hello, Sam. And he's explaining to me about his business. He got into the crypto space because there was very wide, inefficient spreads that he could take advantage of. Sam's narrative is a interesting narrative, meaning his self-narrative. His pitch was, I was a graduate of MIT. I wanted to work in charity. I went to get interviewed by many different charities and NGOs. And the message from those NGOs and charities is, yes, you can have a low-paying job here and try to help us affect change, or you can go out into the marketplace, work on Wall Street, build a business, and then have an amazing amount of net worth and then migrate your net worth to us through effective altruism. Those are your two choices. And after meeting with these charities, I made a decision, this is Sam talking, to go to Wall Street to see if I could have an impact that way. I went to Jane Street, started out as a programmer and a quant trader, and I had an algo, I had an algorithmic trading model that I was using to help me make money. and I noticed that there was very large spreads in the cryptocurrency markets that I could take advantage of. And then I decided, you know what? This is an amazing opportunity. I can make millions of dollars for myself. I'm going to leave Jane Street. I'm going to convince a few people to come with me from Jane Street. And I'm going to go out and build myself a cryptocurrency trading arbitrage group to take advantage of these spreads. What Sam explained to me is that he saw discrepancies. The market was so early, the cryptocurrency markets were so early, that there were discrepancies in different exchanges. So, for example, Bitcoin could be trading at a certain number in the United States on Coinbase, but on something like OKX or Kraken or even Mt. Gox before Mt. Gox failed, it could be trading at a different price in Asia. And so there was an arbitrage opportunity. Let's say it was trading at a higher price in the United States. He could buy it on an Asian exchange, and then he could trade it on the United States exchange for a profit. Now, that happened in the over-the-counter securities that ultimately became the NASDAQ back in the 60s and 70s. There were very wide spreads in those stocks, and broker-dealers and investment bankers made a lot of money out of those early-stage technology stocks until that market matured, and then we went to decimalization, and then the spreads became very tight. But in Sam's case, what he was discovering, whether it was Bitcoin or Ethereum as it was getting started, they were not trading sort of at the same price globally. And so that made for an interesting opportunity, and he was taking advantage of it. He started in Alameda County, California, doing this, and he felt that there was too much regulatory pressure, or there was too much of a lack of understanding of regulation in the area. He said, okay, I don't want to get myself in trouble, so I'm going to move the operation to Hong Kong, where they will allow me to trade without this burdensome regulation, or to put it more accurately, without this burdensome, vague, questionable, always over-questioning yourself if you're doing the right or wrong thing, because there's no clear roads, regulatory roads, in the United States. We have not yet taken a position about whether or not these are securities or commodities. And if they're securities, you could be in a violation, a securities regulation violation, if you have quote-unquote inside information and you're doing this. If it's commodities, there's no such thing as inside information. So there was a big discrepancy about that, so he decided to leave the United States and go to Hong Kong, where there was no issue either way. And he had a little bit more freedom to do this in Hong Kong. And so he moves to Hong Kong. He's minting money in Hong Kong. He's minting money. Minting money means he's making spreads of 3, 4, 5, 10%. So if he's got $100,000 on, he's buying the Bitcoin at $100,000. He's selling it at $110,000 on a different exchange. If it's $100 million on, he's making $10 million off that spread. He's making large spreads. And remember, these are riskless. Because if I'm buying here and I'm selling there and I'm capturing the spread, even if the market moves, I don't have any risk on. Okay, so these are riskless trades, taking advantage of gross market inefficiencies, because the market is so nascent, it's so early, it doesn't have enough brokers, it doesn't have enough exchange makers, you know, making markets in these different currencies to tighten the exchanges and to tighten the markets and make them more efficient. There's widespreads. Sam is taking advantage of this. He's making good money, but in his mind, he's not making enough money because he doesn't have enough money. But what if I could have more money and I could get that money freely? Well, the way I could do that is I could set up an account. They could use my algorithms. They could use my trading methodologies. They can come on to this account platform and my app, if you will, buy and sell crypto. I'll take a spread from them, so I'll get some profits that way. But when they have cash in their accounts, I'll sweep the cash into their accounts into my account. And a result of which, I'll be using their money as rocket fuel to boost my trading arbitrages, which will increase my net revenues and increase my income. And of course, in a bull market, when everything's rising, that's working beautifully. In a bear market, the tide goes out and you see who's swimming half naked and he gets blown up. There's a number of different things that send him on the way. The first thing that sends him on the way is the move to Hong Kong. That's making him some money. The second thing that sends him on the way is he gets some venture capitalists like Sequoia and others involved in the business. He's a very impressive guy. He tells a very impressive story. And as we all know, Sequoia famously profiled him on their website and their magazine as one of their big, young, emerging, extremely opportunistic, extremely commercial entrepreneurs. Sequoia is named after the Sequoia trees in the Pacific Northwest or the Northwest region of California. You know, they're a Silicon Valley venture capital shop. They've been around for two decades, maybe three or four decades, I don't know exactly how long, but they're considered to be one of the more renowned venture capitalists. They've backed a lot of early stage technology companies and have made reams and reams of money, and they're known for their due diligence and they're known for their screening process. And so when Sam bags them as a investor, it is a good signal to other investors that Sam is the right person. You've now met the right person at the right place and the right time, as endorsed by Sequoia.
My name is Tracy Wang. I am a deputy managing editor at CoinDesk, and I have been covering the FTX story since last November and also FTX and Alameda Research for years before that. I think he was a very charismatic founder. If you think about, you know, the types of people that venture capitalists like to invest in, Sam clearly fit that bill. He was a very well-educated guy. He had come from a background. He had previously worked at a very prestigious Wall Street trading firm, and everybody had the impression that he was this like genius whiz kid. And he had the kind of like the antics to support it. Like, he always walked around looking a little schlubby in a FTX t-shirt and his New Balance sneakers. He would sleep on a beanbag, and you know, there'd be pictures that surface on Twitter of Sam being such a hardworking founder that he would sleep on this beanbag at the FTX offices, and people really like were enamored with that portrait that he painted of himself. He was definitely a media darling. He knew how to talk to reporters. He was very open also. You know, a lot of people, you know, get scared by reporters. They don't want to talk to them. And he was able to kind of, you know, get himself on the covers of all these magazines because he essentially gave people what they wanted. He would be like, yeah, I'll do this interview. He would, you know, pose for photo shoots and generally be pretty open with the press. And also, lastly, FTX ran a great marketing campaign. They bought the rights to the Miami Heat Stadium, had all these high-profile partnerships with people like Tom Brady. And that was really, I think, a crucial step to kind of moving FTX from just a big player in the realm of crypto to a company that became a little bit more of a household name.
They're tear gassing the people in Hong Kong as he's speaking to me, and so he's thinking about moving out of Hong Kong to a better regulatory environment. He's coming across incredibly articulate. He's very, very smart. I'm taking him at his word that he's made this money legitimately, and I'm taking him at his word that he has a long-term vision to build his business known as FTX. He's explaining that he wants to have a U.S. business. He will eventually merge the international business with the U.S. business once there's regulatory clarity. He wants to be an everything exchange. He does not want to be just a cryptocurrency exchange. He's starting there, but he believes that every security will be tokenized. Stocks will be tokenized. Bonds will be tokenized. Eventually, illiquid assets like real estate and art will be tokenized, and he wants to bring the exchange mechanism or the transaction mechanism into the 21st century. The two big exchanges in the United States, the New York Stock Exchange, started in the 18th century, 1790. The Chicago Mercantile Exchange started in the 19th century, 1890. But he wants to start the first 21st century exchange where instead of doing a transaction and waiting 2 days for it to settle, By the way, when I started in the industry, you did a transaction, you waited 5 business days for it to settle. Sam wants to go from T, transaction, plus 0. He wants it to be on the blockchain, boom, the thing transfers without all these countless intermediaries. It saves everybody money, it makes it more efficient, and it's a very exciting vision for what he wants to do. I said, okay, listen, I have NYDIG as our principal sponsor. If you'd like to come in for $750,000, we can make you the, you know, second sponsor tier. But that'll afford you all these different activities and all these different availabilities. And by the way, I'll take you to my VIP dinner, which there'll be political leaders there, hedge fund leaders, a whole assortment of venture capitalists, sovereign wealth funds, etc. Yes, I'd like to do that. And then he wires us $750,000 pretty quickly. We sign a sponsorship deal. Moreover, I say to Sam, well, I'm an early stage seed investor in something called Ledger X. Ledger X is a company that has a few derivative licenses that it's gotten from the CFTC. You could buy Ledger X and truncate the process of getting those licenses. Would you have an interest in meeting with those people? Yes, I would. And so he goes to the Bitcoin conference in Miami. I fly the Ledger X people into Miami. They have dinner together at Carbone. That happens, I want to say, late June of 2021. And that transaction consummates in October of 2021, where he buys Ledger X for $300 million. So here I am. I'm helping Sam. He's got a vision. I've got relationships, 3+ decades of relationships. My relationships, some of them, frankly, are older than Sam has been on planet Earth. And I'm helping him execute his business. And he's enjoying our relationship because it is a fluid relationship dynamic. I'm transferring generational relationships to a younger man who's going to execute this broad-based, frankly, very amazingly insightful, brilliant vision of what an exchange should look like. We do some homework, but I'm not a bullshitter. We don't do a tremendous amount of homework on Sam until we're about to enter into a long-term relationship with him, a long-term sponsorship relationship with him. But no, at that moment, I'm taking prima facie that he has money. I'm taking prima facie that he's already signed a deal with Major League Baseball. They're going to carry his logo on the umpires' jerseys. He's affiliated with the NBA. They've got the naming rights for the FTX Arena in Miami. And he's growing and building his business, and he wants to get into the traditional finance relationships, and he wants to use the SALT conference to do that. And so this right now is still in what I would describe as a transactional relationship. He's going to give us a little bit of money to help us with our conference. We're going to give him time and energy to help him build his relationships. But we connect. I'm not a bullshitter. I'm not going to tell you that I didn't like him. I'm not going to tell you I didn't enjoy his company or think he was very, very smart. He's eccentric, and he's coming across nasally, and he's wearing T-shirts, and he's got you know, he's got gym shorts from probably 1978 that his father was probably wearing in middle school, and he's got white socks and New Balance sneakers. He looks a little off. I'm not saying that he doesn't, but think of these great internet leaders. Think of these guys. You know, I thought he was the Mark Zuckerberg of crypto. When Mark Zuckerberg came on the scene, and I was in Davos, Switzerland, witnessing this, he showed up with a T-shirt and a hoodie and blue jeans, and people are like, what the F? And they looked at him and thought he was nuts. And he went on to build Facebook. It was a $1 trillion company for a short period of time, but it's still a $300 billion company. So when you're looking at people that are somewhat odd or eccentric, take a look at the top 10, 20 billionaires in our society. They're a little quirky. I mean, who's kidding who? Okay, and sometimes quirkiness is a byproduct of genius or a byproduct of forceful execution. I did not think at that time Sam was nefarious. He was a distracted man. He was also somebody that could do a lot of different things at the same time. That was the way his brain chemistry worked. So, you know, he was playing video games, taking television interviews on Bloomberg and CNBC. He was you know, often very distracted, and he was tapping his foot while he was talking to you, or he was in a realm of doing two or three things at the same time. So some people are very good at that. Some people are not very good at that. You know, I felt that Sam was good at that. I thought that that was like sort of an extra layer of brain chemistry that was helping him achieve. I think a lot of that stuff was backfiring on him and caused him to make a lot of misjudgments. I thought that he was well-raised. He had parents that were tenured professors at Stanford Law School. He had a list of investors in his company that were well-known. Some of those people, frankly, are personal friends of mine. And so we began our journey.
Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loan subject to approval in available locations.